Listen to shoot the defence. It's unbelievable, Jeff.
Hello and welcome to Shooting Defence on FNX, brought to you by My Sports Aid, Youth Energy and Save Association. I'm your host, Stel, and my co-hosts, as ever, are Yannickis and Rodri Giggs. How are you doing, little man?
Not bad.
You okay?
Yeah, good.
Have you recovered from last week's abuse?
Starts again tonight.
That's all right, we'll take it easy. We'll give you a short one. Rod, how you doing, buddy?
Yeah, I'm good, fellas. Yeah, I'm good. Good
how weekend. Was London?
Yeah, I'm still here, so yeah, it's good.
your cold has disappeared. You left London and you're back to normal.
Yeah, and the Wi-Fi has improved, so happy days.
great stuff. Well, our guest tonight is highly respected journalist and author of the upcoming book, Two Tribes. It's none other than Tony Evans. Tony, great to have you back on the show, mate. Absolutely wonderful to have you back on Shoot the Defence.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Stella, and it's been too long.
Listen, you're always welcome to come back on, mate. You know, the last time we spoke in great length about Brendan Rodgers at Liverpool, and I'm sure we'll go into that a bit later. But let's talk about this weekend's Premier League games, and we'll begin at the home of the champions and an entertaining goalless draw between Chelsea and Arsenal. Now, the main talking point, however, was the straight red card issued to David Luiz for a challenge on Alexis Sanchez. Now, Tony, my initial reaction to the challenge was he's off, not just because he went over the ball or the pitch side mic, which happened to make it sound like a bone-crunching challenge, but the red issue to Mane last week seems to have opened somewhat of a can of worms. What's your take on the Luiz red card, mate?
Well, I think it was completely justified. It was a reckless challenge. And when people put themselves in situations where they're in danger from fellow professionals, I think they should be sent off. You know, people say they're taking tackles out the game. That wasn't a tackle. That was a reckless challenge. One of the problems is people don't know how to tackle anymore. If you're going to tackle, it's easy to tackle. You know, you keep your both feet on the ground and you go for the ball, and that's great. But when you leave the ground, your studs are showing, you're going to get sent off. When you put a fellow professional in danger, you should go.
That's right, absolutely. Now, with David Luiz, he's got a tendency of doing this. He's got previous, hasn't he? Is it a case of he just will never learn?
Yeah, there's a little bit of that going on. When Rafa had him at Chelsea, he was astounded by his physicality and his power and his skills. But he was like, why didn't someone teach him to play football? He's 25 now and no one's ever taught him to play football. So there's that element in this, we all know that Gary Neville calls him a PlayStation footballer. And there's a bit of that, so there's a bit of truth there. He's got prodigious skills, but he's a bit over-exuberant with his physicality.
That's right. And Rod, that's Chelsea's fourth sending off of the season, which is a bit of a surprise given Conte is somewhat of a disciplinarian. Are cracks appearing, mate? Is the pressure getting to these players?
I think there are fault lines at Stamford Bridge, which can widen at any moment. I think since Mourinho left in the first time, they built a system there that minimises the power and impact of a manager, and that creates various uncertainties. And I think that's happened again this summer, where Conte didn't get the players that he wanted in the transfer market. And I think it's not quite a club that functions in a sensible, that's the wrong word, in a traditionally coherent manner. So there's always a chance of things going wrong. I mean, the last two managers there to win the league, two out of the last three managers to win the league, were sacked before, by the end of the next season. And I wouldn't be altogether shocked if Conte gives us a hat-trick. He's a great manager, but perhaps he's not been allowed to express himself as he would be at other clubs, and I think that filters down to the players.
Yeah, that's right. And Rob, what do you make of Chelsea's disciplinary record? I mean, we saw it over the years with Arsenal and their disciplinary, issues. Do you think there's a little bit of that going on at Chelsea?
Not necessarily. I think that if we go through the sending off, Gary Cahill's was you know, it could happen in a game. He's overrun the ball. He's gone over top the ball. He's a bit reckless. He's got a red card for it. Fabregas was two yellows, which is petulant with being experienced he's got. And you know, David Luiz can be reckless, and it obviously was a red card. I can't remember the fourth one, but you know, he's totally different from last season. They've got games coming thick and fast now in the week. They haven't got the whole week to prepare, mind and body. So you know, it's a lot different from last year. So yeah, they've got to adapt quickly. They can't keep on getting people sent off because you know they're behind the two Manchester clubs at the moment, and they can't be dropping more clubs with people getting sent off and losing points that way.
Mm-hmm. I think the concern in this case is that David Luiz, whether we like it or not, is a senior figure at Chelsea now, vice captain. You know, Gary Cahill hasn't got the legs, so to speak, so he needs David Luiz there with him.
Well, really come on, let's not be too critical, because since he's come back, he's surprised a whole lot of us, because he was reckless before he was, when he was here the first time at Chelsea. So when he's come back, he's done really well. He's not been as reckless as he was. He won the league. You know, he can be petulant. He can lose his temper like that, and he can be reckless. So it's these South Americans. Rojo did it last year. These South Americans, I don't think they learn how to tackle over there.
It's a fair point. But with him out for three games, effectively, they're going to have to rely on Christensen or Rudiger, and two players who, okay, Christensen did very well in Bundesliga, to the fact that the side that he was on loan to wanted to buy him outright. And Rudiger is fairly new to the Premier League. So, you know, as Piliquata can slot in at central defence, I don't know how they'll cope without him. But, you know,
going on to the... Zappa Costa as well, didn't
he?
David Luiz is an experienced player. I'm sure he's apologised to all his teammates because, you know, he's left his team in the mire with him being sent off and missing games. So, you know, he'll be a miss, but they'll just have to adapt and overcome it.
Mm. Going back to what Rodri said, sorry, Steph. I think Luiz has adapted playing three at the back. I don't think he's accomplished enough to play in a back four. I think he's too much of a liability to play in a back four.
Yeah,
I think so. As two in there, I think with three, he's got another two defenders to get him out of trouble. Yeah, he's matured a bit as a player and as a defender, but you can't take it out of his game. And I don't know. I just think the three suits him better than the four.
Mm. Yes, it allows him to bring the ball out of defence, yeah, doesn't it? But Pedro was one of the players that was sent off. In fact, it was the first player that was sent off at the beginning of the season in the Community Shield against Arsenal. And he missed a great chance at one end, while Welbeck, Ramsey and Lacazette probably should have done much better with their chances. Was that a fair result?
Yeah, I think so. Overall, I didn't personally think it was a good game. For two teams who you always seem to have a lot of goals in their games, it was very tight. But I'm going to give credit to Arsenal. And actually Arsene Wenger, he went with a game plan for once. You know, and it just shows that when you actually run into a game plan, with a game plan, you can actually go and get a result. He dropped Ozil, where, you know, it's a liability for me. He got everybody working as a unit, as a team. Defensively, they look solid. Chelsea created, what, one, two chances possibly the whole game? So you've got to give Arsenal credit for that. And they look dangerous going forward as well. So, fair result. And for me, Arsenal shaded it on Sunday. I thought they were a better side.
Mm, absolutely. Well, Mourinho and Guardiola appear to have transferred their La Liga rival into the Premier League as their sides slowly pull away from the rest. City smashed Watford 6-0 while United grabbed another 4-0 victory. But don't let the scoreline fool you. It was far from convincing, wasn't it?
How did it finish 4-0? I really don't know. It was, I mean, with 5 minutes to go, all my nails went, to be honest. I mean, it looked like Everton were going to get an equaliser. And then, you know, a dreadful mistake from Williams. Mkhitaryan makes it 2-0. And then just flagged it. It's just open after. It's like Everton just kind of went to pots, to be fair. It was a strange kind of game. For the first half an hour, United were brilliant. You know, brilliant goal by Valencia. Lukaku could have made it 2-0. They looked solid. And then it seemed like, you know, just before half-time, Everton started to get a foothold of the game. And second half, first half an hour was all Everton, really. They had a couple of chances. They didn't create a lot, but they looked dangerous going forward. Strange game, but again, United seem to score late on. There's another three goals, you know, in the space of 5 minutes. They've done it three times now this season. So it could be a sign where teams are, you know, either pushing forward or tiring. United, can exploit teams at the latter stages of games, which is encouraging. Mm.
Yeah, but
yeah, I got to say, I agree with that. One of the things that Mourinho has done since he arrived at Old Trafford is he's bought power and strength. And, out of all the players that have come in there, there's only one of them is under 6 foot. They're all huge. He's built a Mkhitaryan. He's the only one who's short. He's 5'10". The rest of them are monsters. Yeah. And they Mourinho is setting out to physically bully the Premier League. And what happens is, even though they have flat spells in games, because they're not the finished product yet, and the defence is still a bit dodgy, but they will wear people down. They'll wear them down in the midfield, and they'll wear defenders down. And suddenly there's a lot of goals later on. And, it's very similar to what he did in his first spell at Chelsea. And very impressive it is, too.
That's right. Well, Rod, Everton had a couple of chances to level it up, mate, Wayne Rooney being the culprit of two glaring misses. Now, while United have only conceded twice this season, I still believe a lot of work needs to be done defensively. What do you think?
Yeah, we've seen it in the last two games now where, there can be... everyone knows this, that the weakness is still the defence and he's still not got it right. You know, I think Baez can make, he's got an odd mistake, and we've seen Phil Jones has got an odd mistake in him. So you've just got to get that balance right and just got to get that consistent. Try and cut these silly mistakes out, because obviously the Stoke goals could have been avoided easily, especially by Phil Jones. I felt that the two goals at Stoke were both at his fault, the way his position was the first one, and obviously the second one it was his man who scored the corner. So, but they'll have to keep on working it. But Mourinho's renowned for winning his defence, so I'm sure he'll get it right. And I agree what Tony says. You can see what he's doing now.
I just want to agree with you, and I think if Mourinho wins the league with Phil Jones, then we'll never need any more proof of his genius.
And Smalling.
I think with United, they need to nail the left-back position. I think it's a massive problem for United, the left-back position. They've tried 5-6 different players in there, and just no one seems to settle in that position.
Well, they put the eggs in the basket with Luke Shaw, and obviously his injury record isn't great. I don't know whether it's a lack of confidence. Maybe it's a mental thing with him. Dali Blind has come in. He's done pretty well.
Young's played there. Rojo's played there. Yeah. Damian's played there. Yeah. Ashley Young played there Sunday. It just seems that everybody's just, go on the left and see what happens. And United needs to address that in the summer, for me.
But you mentioned earlier that, Everton got in behind United and they look dangerous on the counter. Is it me or did both sides look really leggy?
Surprisingly, United looked more leggy than Everton. Mm. And Everton were the team that went to Italy to play Atalanta on Thursday. But
they made a lot of changes.
They did make a lot of changes, but it was surprising. It seems to me, watching United, especially this season, they've slowed the play a lot down this season. They seem to be a lot more patient, a lot more... short passes and like what Tony said, it seems to, wear teams down at the end. That's where United, I think, seem to get their energy, like last 10, 15 minutes. But you're right. Surprisingly, for a team that, played on Tuesday at home and then played again at home on Sunday, they did look lucky. They didn't look fresh United on Sunday at all. Mm. As for Everton, they seem to kind of growing more confidence as the game went on. And once the second goal went in, you can see their legs went. They were gone after that. So they started feeling the effect of the game and the game on Thursday. But Everton will struggle with the Europa in the league. If they're feeling the effects already at the start of the season, they're in for a big season.
Yeah. Well, Tony, Everton have only found the net twice in the league, and Sunday's defeat moved them into the bottom three. Rooney isn't the answer, though, is he?
Well, he's the answer to a different question. What he was bought for is to give them some experience, also give Everton some projection across the world. And let's face it, there's lots of fans across the globe who kind of regarded Everton as a disposable Premier League club and not really, sort of one of the main ones. Rooney was more famous than them, so he gives them profile. He'll also be good when they want to recruit players. I mean, Steven Gerrard at Anfield, when Dalglish was there, they used to get him to phone potential transfer targets and say, come and play with me. And people love that. And he'll do that on the pitch. He doesn't have the pace. He doesn't have the he just have to touch these days to get them where they want to be. And this is where the big failure in recruitment came in the summer. They didn't get anyone to replace Lukaku, and more to the point, they didn't get any pace up front or at the back. So they're very, very pedestrian. So 100% right, Rooney's not the answer, not to the problem of getting Everton into the top four. But he will do other things for them. In the here and now, he's probably going to be the scapegoat for a lot of things that go wrong this year.
That's right. I agree. Especially with his off the field antics, which have got him into a bit of trouble. I think that always clouds fans' judgment of him. Let's be honest, he's been a remarkable servant to Manchester United, especially to English football. But it just appears that his reputation is kind of damaging his legacy, so to speak.
If things were going well on the football field, I think that would be brushed under the table pretty quickly. But if things are obviously not going well on the football field, that gets highlighted much, much more. So he needs to need Everton to win a few more games, and then that drink driving stuff will go away.
Yeah, but Rod, if Ronald Koeman was Sir Alex, would that have come out in the media, you reckon?
What will have come out in the media?
The whole thing with with
the drinking,
yeah, the drinking and the ban and all that kind of stuff.
It's difficult to say. It's difficult to say. Would you have made that same mistake? Probably not.
Touche. Well, gents, Aguero, he bagged this sixth hat trick for Man City. Now, I've always wondered why many experts don't see him as one of the best Premier League strikers ever. Where do you rate the Argentinian? How about you? Let's start with you first, since you're about his height, if not shorter.
Highly. Fantastic footballer. Fantastic finisher. He's a legend at City. I mean, he won them the league title, as everyone knows, and his goals and everything that he brings as well. I mean, I think Guardiola's very, what's the word? He's very critical of him. He wants him to do maybe other things that Aguero is not known for. He wants him to play football or come short and link up. He's a goal scorer. Mm-hmm. Give him the ball, give him half a chance, or put the ball in the back of the net. You can get other players to do that for him. He doesn't need to do that. So I don't know if he's trying to make Aguero into this player that he's not. Let him do his job for me. But as a player, he's definitely one of the best strikers that come to the Premiership.
Absolutely. Tony, what do you make of him?
Well, I love Aguero. You know what? In this game, scoring goals is everything. And I would just build a team around him. The problem is, Pep wants him to press. And, I mean, from what I'm being told from people at City, is, you know, Pep thinks he'll close down the first man, you know, good enough. The second man, he'll make sort of lip service to chase him down. And then the third man, he's not going to press him at all. And Guardiola doesn't like that. He wants him to work. There's another thing, though, going on. Guardiola doesn't really like senior players who challenge his view of the game. And Aguero and Vincent Kompany have been round the block. They've been in the Premier League. They know how it works. And sometimes when Pep's, you know, saying, we'll do this and do that, they're like, this isn't going to work, boss. He doesn't like that. And so when you add these things together, the negative noises coming out about the Etihad, about Aguero, are mind-boggling. There was a suggestion that if Pep would have had his way, he definitely would have gone in a swap for on deadline day. But staying ahead above Pep, the Etihad, you know, said no chance. And let's face it, Alexis Sanchez for Aguero. I know I'm keeping the man who scores goals and wins titles.
That's right. I agree. Totally. Rod.
Yeah, he's up there. He's up where Suarez for me. Obviously, Suarez's work rate is a lot more than Aguero, but his finishing is just first class. There's not many goal scorers in Premier League history that are better finishers than Sergio Aguero. He's up there with the likes of Robbie Fowler, Ian Wright, Suarez himself, all the top, Ruud van Nistelrooy, the top strikers that you give him a chance and he put them away.
The thing is, he's not physical, is he? When you look at his frame, he's not a big burly striker, you know. No,
but he's grown up in South American, like a street footballer. You know, he's that type of player. You know, so he's had a tough school growing up, no doubt. And he was a goal scorer. He was in Atletico Madrid, so it's no surprise that he's continued it at Manchester City. He's just, like I say, he's a world class top striker.
Mm-hmm. I was hating though. Broke my heart when he scored that goal against Cooper.
Yeah, but listen, 94th minute, the ball falls to him. You know, there's so much pressure in that moment.
Yeah.
And he put it away.
Why didn't he fall to Balotelli or something?
True. But no, I think he's phenomenal, man. I had the I wouldn't say an argument, a little disagreement with Leon Knight a while back about Aguero. I said Aguero reminds me of how Romario used to be. You know, his frame, you know, the way his movement off the ball, the way he could just get into positions like that and it was just phenomenal. And I think Aguero is up there with him. And obviously Leon disagreed because Leon's Leon. But yeah, I mean, Aguero, he's only 3 goals away from becoming Man City's leading ever goal scorer. I think Eric Brooke remains the club's top marksman, a record that's lasted 77 years. You want
to? Says it all, doesn't
it? Oh, there you go. Right, on to Liverpool, Chinese team. And their boss, Jurgen Klopp, told the BBC he was angry with the result but pleased about the performance, following his side's 1-1 draw against Burnley. Now, Tony, a lot has happened at Anfield since you were last on the show, mate. Klopp replaced Brendan Rodgers, and to his credit, he's changed the mood around the club. That being said, while Liverpool have done well against the big boys, as Yannick always tells me, they seem to struggle to grind out results against the lesser sides, so to speak. Should Liverpool fans be concerned?
Well, yeah, I think they should be. I think Klopp was the best manager Liverpool could have got at the time Rodgers was sacked, and I think he's the best manager they can get now. So I don't think anyone should be going down the Klopp out route. But there are things that you need to worry about. Defensively, they still leak goals. The midfield is still incoherent, and they're not clinical enough to put teams away. And what worries me most is, and it's shown itself in recent weeks, is Klopp just can't understand why the defence is getting lots of criticism. He's going, why is everyone praising what we do going forward? And, look at the scoreboard, Jürgen, and that might give you a clue. When he came to Anfield, it seems he hadn't really thought about things like goalkeepers or defences at Dortmund. He just, expected them to get on with it. And now he's found himself in a situation where he's going to have to pay some attention to them. But after the Crystal Palace game a couple of years ago, the one when Benteke scored in the last minute, the penalty, he was really pleased and quite elated afterwards. And I said to him, the last question in the press conference, I said, Jürgen, I said, can we talk about set pieces? I said, because Palace scored one, hit the bar, and had 3 other chances from them. I said, are you going to have them at Melwood this week working on them? And he went, we don't talk about that because we won. And I was like, I'm talking about it. And the thing is, here we are, sort of, we're 18 months on, and still the same things are happening in the same way. And at some point, someone's got to be held to account. And I think this is a something that, Klopp really needs to address quickly.
Tony, is it a case of he's set in his own ways? Because we know that Arsene Wenger brought in Steve Bould to replace Pat Rice, and he's supposed to be more like a defensive coach more than anything. Is there any chance that Klopp will bring in someone from the old guard, like Carragher or something like that?
I doubt it. I mean, we're in the same situation, aren't we, really, as last time we spoke, when everyone was saying Brendan Rodgers needs to bring in a defensive coach. Who'd have thought 2 years after Brendan Rodgers has gone, we'd be saying the same things? I think, there's been a problem in recruitment at Anfield. They haven't, and this predates Klopp, predates Rodgers, really, that they haven't been able to isolate good defenders and bring them in and give the manager the raw materials he needs to put a good defence together. So I think that's one issue. And the other one is, I think Klopp lives by the trust, believe, support and believe ethic. He has changed the mood at Anfield. He's got that effervescent personality. But if you want us to believe, and then you're saying that they looked for Virgil van Dijk in the summer, and they couldn't find any centre-halves in the whole of Wales football who were good enough to come into that defence. But then, frankly, I'm not believing it. And if you say things like that, I think there's a bit of delusion going on. So, yeah, and I think I think the mood among the fans and Liverpool fans are loyal, but there's no quicker journey from saviour to scapegoat than at Anfield, and I sense a little bit of mood turning against them, which a bit disappointed them really.
Mm, that's right. That's right. And we've discussed Liverpool's defensive frailties on numerous occasions, and we all agree that they won't get anywhere near a title challenge unless they improve. Now, it seems, as you said, they put the golden egg, that's Virgil van Dijk, in one basket and ended up settling for the ugly duckling Clavan. Now, has the club let down Klopp, or was there more to it than just Southampton's reluctance to do business?
Well, it was inexperience, and it was dreadful inexperience. I mean, the Van Dijk wanted to come to the club. The deal was done with him, and there was some gloating going on in the media. And suddenly, someone in Southampton said, "Shouldn't someone have asked us?" So that was amateurish. But I think I think there is some truth when you say have the club let him down in recruitment. I go back to 2014. In the January 2014, when Brendan Rodgers wanted a defender, and they were just about to embark on that run to, sort of the attempt to win the title. And a very, very senior person at Anfield I spoke to, and I said, they were pursuing Salah. I said, why aren't you getting a defender? Because, Rodgers wants a defender. He said, there are no defenders out there. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, we recruitment people, the staff, they all tell me there's no defenders out there. And I said, look, as far as I'm concerned, defenders are the cheapest and easiest position to fill. If you tell me there's no 30-goal-season strikers out there, I'll go, yeah, that's fine. But no defenders. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he came back to me the next day. He said, I've been back to them again. And, they've assured me that there are no defenders. And I was like, my instinctive reaction would be go back and sack the entire recruitment staff. And I don't think they've improved by very much since then. Certainly not in terms defensively. They seem to be able to isolate good, quick players who can play up front, and certainly have given Klopp the raw materials for a brilliant attack. But the defence, the midfield, the goalkeeper, they all remain issues, and they seem no nearer to finding people who can actually slot in and do the job.
So, in a nutshell, how long do you think Klopp has got before the pressure starts to climb all over his back, so to speak?
Well, I think from fans, I would say if it carries on like this to Christmas, I think there'll be growing clamour and annoyance about him. I think inside the grounds, I think the owners love him. They're still besotted with him, and I think J.W. Henry, the way he looks at Klopp, Linda gets jealous. They love him, I think that will I think that will carry him a long way. But if as I say, we're coming up to the second anniversary of him being at the club, and if by the end of the season there's no real progression, I think there needs to be a root and branch sort of look at the club and decide how they can go forward. And I think Klopp still will be, at the end of the season, the best manager he can get. I am not so sure the infrastructure at Anfield is good enough for any manager to succeed.
That's right. Tony, just one more thing on Klopp. You mentioned just then that FSG love him, and he's exactly the man that they want. Is it because of his personality? Because we know him as the heavy metal football manager, and he's very outspoken and very colourful, so to speak, on the touchline. Is it because it's the whole razzmatazz thing that the Americans love? But is it something more?
He's got great character, and he's got a very winning character. There is a core of steel and anger in him, which I like. The thing is, when he came into the club, let's say 2 years ago, he told the owners, he said, this group of players, that's here, I think they're good enough, I think I can compete in all four competitions we're in. Well, two things were going on there. He was either telling the owners what they wanted to hear, or he hadn't watched Liverpool. But what he needed to do was come in and say, look, these fellas aren't good enough. We need to get new players in. And I think Klopp's big problem is he's come in and he's kind of trusted his own ability you a little bit too much and thought, you know what, I can do it with this lot. And I think perhaps he was probably overestimating it. Like I say, a combination of Jock Steen, Bill Shankly and Brian Clough might struggle to dominate with this lot. So yeah, but the owners, they really love his personality. They love the way he projects the club. And, you know, he's a great personality. I would say almost every club in the world has won him, and you know, apart from a handful, and I think he's the best person Liverpool could get. But I think he needs help. I don't think he can do it on his own, and I don't think the recruitment structure and from the boardroom downwards, I don't think they are good enough. They are astute enough to give a manager of Klopp's stature the best opportunities to win.
Going back to that, Klopp's enthusiasm, personality won't win Liverpool football matches. He's too naive as a manager.
There is an element of that, and you've got questions, tactics and substitutions.
Absolutely, I think tactically he's not there. I mean, I just want to go back a couple of weeks. Last week at the City game. You don't go to your rivals and get beat 5-0, even if you've got 10 men, for me. You're 1-0 down with 10 men. All right, 2-0 before half-time, fine. Second half, shut up. Mm. Make it difficult. Take a 2-0 defeat and then build confidence.
You've got loads of pace, and City have got no defence. So you go down to 10 men and you go 1-0 down. Well, you know what? Get compact. Make half-time.
Absolutely.
Once you make half-time, you can have a talk about what you want to do. The second half, stay tight. You've got all the pace in the world. If that City defence on the break, you know what? The 2-0 down by half-time, they don't even make the break. And that's staggering. They don't even make the break. And then Klopp makes changes. He takes Salah off.
Yeah.
And it was almost like he'd thrown his hands in. And so why wouldn't the players throw their hands in? I thought it was absolutely shameful. And people going, oh, but we went down to 10 men. You know what? When you're playing City, despite the multitude of riches they've got up front, if you've got good attackers, you've got a chance with them. 10 men or no 10 men. You know, it was an embarrassment.
The thing is, the main criticism I've always had about Klopp is that he doesn't have a plan B. And I'll go back to the same with Brendan Rodgers. And we had this discussion a while back, Tony, whereby if Liverpool had kept Andy Carroll, I think they would have won the league because he gives them something different. He's got the height, the physical ability. Rodgers wanted to play a certain way. He wanted to play intricate football, aesthetically pleasing on the eye. And yeah, it did Liverpool very well. And even though they conceded 51 goals, which is obviously another reason why they didn't win the title, I don't think it's Gerrard slipping that caused Liverpool not to win the league. I think it's not having a plan B in games that could have been won. If you have an Andy Carroll up top with 10 minutes to go, I know it's not the nicest way of playing football and not the Liverpool way, obviously, but if you've got a big guy up there, it made a big difference, wouldn't it?
Oh, you know what? I've been around a long time, and people talk about the Liverpool way. And in fact, you know what? Graeme Souness said to me, he said, the Liverpool way, he said, the only Liverpool way is winning. He said, that's all that matters. He said, like, and traditionally, their view is the great Liverpool teams is, if you come to play with us, we'll play with you. If you come to fight with us, you're going to lose. And they didn't care how they won. They didn't care about the style. What they cared about was the ultimate thing. And, you know, that Brendan Rodgers team, everyone will always look at Stephen's slip. And you know what? Midfield players are entitled to slip in that area of the pitch. What any team are not entitled to do is have the two centre-halves in front of the midfield player when he does fall over. And that was a failure there. And I agree with you. I think there's a certain level of naivety in Klopp's game. He's playing one way. And once teams work it out, they flood the zones where you're gonna run the channels that you're gonna run down. They flood them. They'll sit back. They'll let you have the ball until you get to 25 yards out, and then they'll squeeze the space. And all of a sudden you're starting to shoot from miles out, and you can rack up all the shots you like in the world, but it's going to take something special to score, and they haven't got the people who can unpick defences like that, or who can do different things. You know, that's a situation where if you do get behind them and get crosses in, then you know, back defences, the best way to do is just get to the line, turn them round facing their own goal and get the ball in from there. They're not doing that. So, yeah, I mean, you're not going to get much argument from me.
Fantastic. We agree on something.
Can I ask something else?
Go ahead.
Strange decision, I thought, for me personally, was let Origi go as well. Yeah. Long. I mean, considering Sturridge's injury record, he plays one every kind of 10 games. Firmino, for me, is not an out-and-out striker. Someone like Origi, who is, was, for me, was surprisingly letting go on loan. I personally didn't get that.
He didn't fancy him from, you know, so from the moment Klopp got there. He kind of decided that he wasn't going to be good enough.
He played him a lot last year, though, Tommy, didn't he, Origi?
But I think he's still young. He's a physical presence. I was aware of him. What's a bit disturbing is that people are not improving on the training ground. They're not developing. And again, I think that points to a bit of a problem in terms of the whole infrastructure there. I would have hoped that a player like him would have learned an awful lot from Klopp and at least presented a really good option when things were going wrong.
Great stuff. Well, Roddy, let's move on to a previous Liverpool manager, Rafa Benitez. He seems to be working miracles in Newcastle at the moment. They won their third game on the bounce. They beat Stoke 2-1.
Yeah, as we talked a few weeks ago, I tipped Newcastle to be in trouble, to get relegated. But, you know, you seem to forget Rafa Benitez has won the European Cup with Liverpool, managed Real Madrid. You know, he's a top coach. So, I'm a surprise. No. So, good luck to him. But, you know, they've had a good start. And, like I say, good luck to him. It's no surprise, though. But even though I did tip him to get relegated, I just thought the recruitment wasn't good enough. They didn't bring enough players in, and the squad was too weak. So that's why I thought they'd struggle. But obviously, you know, he's worked his magic, and he's got them 3 wins out of 5.
Yeah, and to be fair, you kind of tipped them to get relegated because you had the feeling that Benitez would walk anyway. So that wouldn't have been a surprise. Then.
I did. And Mancaster was obviously coming out, and there was at loggerheads, it seemed, and yeah, he seemed like he was going to walk. So I didn't think he was going to be there. You're right. Yeah.
Tony, are you surprised Benitez has lasted this long at Newcastle?
No, but only because, let's go back a bit. Yeah, I think that your instincts were right there about him, you know, about him walking. I think, one, if there was another job available, he might have gone to it. He was very, very disappointed that the assurances he was given weren't upheld during the summer. But I think the reason I'm not surprised that he's still there is somehow he managed to let a $6 million clause that he'd have to pay Newcastle get into the contract. Well, not him, the people who negotiated his contract. Mm-hmm. And there he was, doing Newcastle a favour. And somehow, he ends up, if he walks, he has to pay them $6 million. And it could be as much as $6 million. His camp are not altogether sure. It could be between $5 and $6 million. So that keeps him there. So any club coming in is going to make a hefty payment. Before the season, in August, I think in early August, I think he was very, very worried that he wouldn't have enough to stay up. I think he's come to the conclusion now that he can keep this team in the division. And this month is a big month for them. You know, they've got to go to Brighton on Saturday, and if they can, they think they can pick up points there. And if they get through this month, they've played a lot of the teams that, in theory, should be battling with them in the bottom half of the division, and they seem to be doing all right. I still think, watch this space here, because I don't see the relationship with Ashley continuing long term. He's just very, very disappointed. You know, what he went to Newcastle for, and one of the reasons he took the job is they've gone so long without winning anything, and he's a winner. He's won almost everywhere he's been. He wants to win, and he imagines bringing a trophy to Newcastle after all these years. And I think he's come to the conclusion that with this owner, that's probably not going to happen.
Yeah, it's been a bit too quiet lately on the Ashley Benitez front, hasn't it? The past couple of weeks, we haven't heard anything, not even a pin drop. So, you know, that's something big is coming.
Well, Rafa hasn't been well. He had an operation last week. He had a hernia operation a couple of years ago, and it never quite healed. It turned out it was infected. So he had he wasn't there for the Swansea game, and he's been recuperating. So he hasn't been at his belligerent fighting fitness, let's say. But I think keeping Newcastle up this season, which I think he will do, and comfortably, will enhance his reputation, and there will a club will come along who want to win. And if you want to win, Rafa Benitez is your man.
That's right. Going back to Klopp and Wenger about how I personally believe tactically they're not inept. You're looking at a manager who is tactically inept, and Benitez, who with his tactics and his man management and game plans on the pitch with what he's got at Newcastle is getting results. Mm. So sometimes you don't need to have the best players and, you know, all go forward. He's working with what
pragmatic,
he's got.
Isn't he?
He's pragmatic, but he's getting results. He's off on that. Everywhere, he's got, apart from Real Madrid, where he didn't have a good stint there.
And
Inter as well.
And to think Chelsea fans didn't want him because of his links with Liverpool, but here we go, he walks in and he gives him a European trophy. I mean, you can't slate the guy, I'm sorry.
No.
He may not have had a great time at Real Madrid, but let's be honest, who really does? Yeah. Who really does go to Real Madrid and succeeds for a
they didn't want him
time?
From the beginning, so he'd back against the wall when he got there anyway. But I think tactically he's a fantastic manager. Yeah,
absolutely. And another promoted team, Huddersfield, they're not being too bad either. A draw against Leicester keeps them in sixth place. So far, so good for David Wagner's men.
I think they're the most underrated side in the league for me.
Yeah,
I don't think they get enough credit that they deserve for a manager who came in last year and everybody kind of tipped Huddersfield to go down in the Championship for what he's done and what he's doing again in the Premiership. It's astonishing. It's astonishing. A club like Huddersfield, never played in the Premiership. They don't look out of sorts in the league. You know, I look at teams like Brighton. For me, Brighton are not a Premiership team. You know, I'm sorry, Brighton fans, but Huddersfield look like they've got something to give to this league. It's still early stages, it's still the honeymoon period, and you know, if they get a few injuries or suspension, it's a long season, we know that. But wonders, I mean, everybody's probably tipped Huddersfield to go down, and from what they're doing at the moment, you've got to give credit to
I agree, although on the flip side, when you look at it, when they start facing the likes of Liverpool's, United's, Arsenal's, Chelsea's, I think they're going to get a hiding off one of them. And it's
how they react.
I'm interested, interested to see their character, how they react to that, because some teams just, you know, throw in the towel straight away because it damages their confidence and whatnot. But some use it as a positive and say, right, we've got the difficult one out of the way. This is the worst it can be. Let's just kick on.
I don't think Wagner's the type of manager that will let the players be affected. I think he's
quite a motivator.
He's a motivator. I think he'll be like, you played United or City or whoever it was. You lost, no worries. You gave your best. We'll go next game. I think he's that kind of manager where he'll get the best out of these players. And I agree, someone's going to give Huddersfield a hiding, but I think they might stay up.
I think they will. I think I think they're very good. They've got great shape about them, and they're pragmatic. And we said about pragmatic managers. You know, they know when to tuck in and hold. They know when to break. They know when to keep the shape. I've been extremely impressed by them.
I agree.
That's right. So, in other news, Neymar unfollowed Edinson Cavani on Instagram over a dispute over who would take PSG's penalty against Lyon. Now, Unai Emery said he'll step in if they don't resolve their differences over who takes set pieces. Rodri, whatever happened to assigning people to take penalties, mate? It looks like the egos are clashing already in Paris.
Well, there's only going to be one winner with the amount of money they've spent, so, but it's just a... He kind of rubs you up the wrong way, Neymar. He's like a petulant little kid, and maybe Cavani just needs to give him a slap. So,
we know he's going to be out the door.
He is, but you know, Cavani's a £50 million experienced international. It's been around the block, and this prima donna. It's all about me. It just rubs you up the wrong way. He's a fantastic footballer, but it's just his attitude. He just rubs you up the wrong way, I don't think.
To be fair, Rodri, to Cavani, he didn't let him take it. Cavani missed it. He missed it. Keeper saved it.
No, but that's what I'm saying about his personality. This guy's been around the block. He's a weaker person would have given Neymar the ball. But, you know, Cavani's a strong individual and told him where to go. And, you know, obviously he's missed it. But, you know, if another penalty come up 5 minutes later, I'm sure he would have took the next one.
Well, the point you just made, did you watch the game?
I didn't watch it. I saw the highlights.
5 minutes before that, they had a free kick at the edge of the box. And Dani Alves, Cavani, and Neymar were fighting over that one.
Yeah. And Alves gave it to Neymar.
Well, surely it's down to the manager. The manager, if you, as a coach and as you're setting your team up and you're setting who's taking what, the manager must have a name down. You're taking this, you're taking that. Or it's just anarchy, as you can see with the penalty or the free kick. So it's down to the coach, really, to be saying, listen, you're taking it. Otherwise, you look like a bunch of school kids.
Do you think Unai Emery is the type of manager to control Neymar, Cavani, Alves?
No,
I don't think so.
No, yeah, he's not. Listen, when has he ever managed these big names? I know he's at Sevilla for a few years and he did really well with them, but he made them.
Correct,
yeah. Look at him last season, he struggled a lot. They brought in Ben Arfa, they brought in Draxler.
Draxler wants to leave, apparently, already.
There's two things here. First of all, when Ibrahimovic left, like, the noise is coming out of the PSG dressing room as well. Brilliant. Now the ego's gone, we can get on with it. And it turned out not to be not that positive a thing. But the other thing that struck me about it, you know, I talked to players from, you know, the 70s and 80s, you know, they've retired. And you know, in any great team, there are egos and there are fallens out on the pitch. And, you know, they used to be settled on the training ground. That, you know, that frankly, they beat the crud out of each other, you know, put each other in the place if needed. And now, you unfollow someone on Instagram. You know, how times have changed.
Yeah, somebody doesn't block them as well. That'd be funny. Yeah. Right, so over in Cyprus, a little island in the Mediterranean, only pensioners and young children escorted by their mothers were allowed to attend the Apoel versus Anorthosis game on Monday night. Now, this was due to Cypriot FA punishment carried over from last season's clash between both sets of fans. Now, a 17-year-old was actually arrested for attempting to smuggle in stones and petrol in the stadium. Now, you were born and bred out there, I guess?
No, I lived out there.
You lived out there. I'm quite surprised that the Cypriot FA actually stood their ground on this, because we know what they're like. I'm not going to say too much, but they've always turned a blind eye to hooliganism, haven't they?
It's about time they did something, to be fair. For a tiny little island, there's a lot of hooliganism over there. But there's a lot of politics, as we know, in the Cypriot FA. And it's good. It's about time. Something happened over there, and it needs to happen a lot more often.
Have you seen the highlights of that game?
No.
They had the game at the Gassibi, which is obviously a national stadium.
That's right.
And all the seats were white, so you couldn't see whether... Everyone was in the main stand, which is behind the dugout, so that's where the camera is, so you can't see any other fans. So it's almost as if it was behind closed doors. And, you know, remember those home-friendly international games back in the day? What are they called? There was England, Northern Ireland, but it was the...
The home nation.
But it was the under-21.
Under-17, 60s, right?
And all you'd hear is just women screaming and kids and dogs barking. That's exactly what it was like. It was absolutely hilarious. But, you know, we've seen Cypriot games, and, you know, a lot of them descend into farces, don't we? The Omonia fans who brought in a Turkish flag to wind up the Apoel fans, despite the fact that Turkey invaded Cyprus and killed thousands of people. It's just silly. It's politics.
It's surprising with Apoel as well, because they're the biggest club in Cyprus at the moment.
Yep.
They've got the most money. Yep. They're in the Champions League. They've got a lot of authority in the Cypriot FA. So for that to happen, to me, it was very surprising. Mm-hmm. Very surprising.
Yeah, and there's Anorthosis as well, a team who... We've got a bit of previous, haven't they, with the...
Was it the owner taking the money
that's after the Champions League? Yeah, sorry, James, we're just reminiscing it. Allegedly,
£10 million?
Yeah, and obviously got in the Champions League years ago. And at the end of the campaign, allegedly, the owner just took £10 million in a bag and walked off.
Goodbye.
I've never seen that.
If you're going to do it properly.
Exactly. Right. Let's talk about FC Köln. They've criticised Arsenal's security after both clubs were charged by UEFA. The Germans are up for four charges, including setting off flares and fireworks. I don't see anything wrong with that. Tony, I know you feel very strongly about the whole situation. Care to elaborate on what you tweeted on the matter?
Yeah, I mean, fans searching gates has got to be stopped, without a doubt. And those Cologne fans who did that, you know, certainly need to be sanctioned. But to me, it was wider issues. All the Arsenal fans were outraged that there was the Germans sitting in amongst them who had legitimately bought tickets, some of them from the club. And what gets me is this culture that's grown up in England where segregation has caused. People just can't stand rival fans sitting amongst them. You see ridiculous things, you know, every few weeks of families being escorted out because their team scored and a young kid celebrated and grown adults are pointing them to the stewards going, get them out, get them out. You know what? We need to reassess the way we police and steward football games, and we need to accept that fans should be able to mix in certain areas, and maybe then you will get a situation where people are less obnoxious and say things, and don't say the things they say when they're in segregation, because there's people around them, in, you know, so the basic politeness. Segregation came in 1967 in Britain, following 1967, after two games at Upton Park between West Ham and Man United. The first game was in May 67 when United come to win the league at Upton Park, and they were in every part of the ground and there was anarchy. They came again in September, and this time the East End was ready for them, and there was more anarchy. But the response to that was like blanket segregation, certain get that in the fans, and it created a huge us and them situation where, you know, no man's land and fans escorted in and out, and all of a sudden they become they become an alien species and dehumanised, and that did a lot to make hooliganism work. A lot of the great the good academic studies on hooliganism think that segregation actually made it work because people don't have to take responsibility for the things they say and do to people around them, and I think what we should be looking at is certainly in the, you know, you'll always have a home end and you'll always have an away end, but I don't think we should, I think what we should do is we should encourage in the, you know, like main stands and in the, you know, the areas where, well, we're not friendly, more middle class people go and sit. We should encourage a mix of fans, and we should encourage, because I think aggression would die down an awful lot, and the reaction of, you know, there were Cologne fans sitting near me and they were wearing Cologne scarves. Oh, come on, grow up. You know what, and I've been in Spain, I've been in games in Spain where you're sitting there and the away team scores and lots of people in the main stand celebrate, and the locals don't bat an eyelid because you're supposed to celebrate when a goal goes in. That's what football's all about, whether it's you or the opposition. And you know what? Grow up, get over it. And I think what we should do is look at what happened at the Emirates and take the wider issues in football and say, one, we need to get rid of some of these ridiculous laws. For example, it's a crime to drink any alcohol within sight of the pitch. It's stupid, mad. It's from the 80s and a different era. What we should do is look at the way the civil liberties of football fans are infringed on a weekly basis. You know, things like bubble games. The ludicrous thing of someone from Huddersfield, who's a Hull fan, lives in Huddersfield, has travelled to Hull to get a bus to Huddersfield to see the game. Just mad. And finally, what we should do is take a deep, long look at ourselves and how we react to other fans and we react to rival fans and say, is this right? Is this sensible? Or do we need to change things ourselves?
Mm. But Tony, what would you say to people that say, you know, okay, can you imagine Man United and Liverpool fans sat together these days?
There's always flashpoint games, and I'm not saying that Celtic Rangers should ever be a hand-holding thing, but you know, they talk about Liverpool Everton, it's friendly derby, and it's got much less friendly than it was. It's much more antagonistic, let's say, than it was in, say, the 80s, when you'd have 5,000 Evertonians in the cup, you'd have 3,000 Liverpoolians in the street end, and, you know, and they were mixed, you know, it's there, and there was always trouble, you know, you know, at that time, there was always going to be trouble, and you know, and you'll always get stupidity. But I mean, Liverpool and Man United, clearly, you don't want them in the same end. But say, I was at Wigan Liverpool, where the Wigan fans saw a fellow with a son, a Liverpool fan with a son, in the end, and they all started screaming and shouting. They were no threat to anyone, you know, and they ended up going out. And one of them punched the further on the way, and you're like, you know, this is just pathetic. And for a lot of games, I mean, say, for example, Newcastle-Brighton, at the weekend, if there's some Newcastle fans who show up in the Brighton end, I don't think we should be criminalising them or throwing them out. I think what we should be doing is saying, you know, this is not a flashpoint game. Fans should be able to support the team, and if they buy tickets through legitimate channels or they're guests of other people, then I think we've got to say, you know, good luck to them and good luck to their team. And yeah, the flashpoint games, we know where they're coming and we know what to do. When West Ham play Millwall, you know, it's never going to be it's never going to be people sitting together. But I think for most games, we don't need such strict segregation, and we don't need the whingers pointing out people who are no threat in the crowd and asking them for them to be thrown out. That, to me, is the lowest of the low in football support terms.
The thing is, I know it's club football and international football are two completely different animals, but you see it in the World Cup and the European Championships and even the Copa America, you always have fans mixing with each other. You've got mixed zones in off the pitch outside. So I don't see why we can't bring it into play out here. Even Fulham have got a neutral zone, as they call it, and you always tend to find home and away fans in that bit anyway. So
yeah.
Of course, it's tension.
Agree.
You think?
I think so.
Yeah.
Mm. Big game, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know why. I don't know why it should cause tension though, because it's the football culture, unfortunately. Because I'm a big rugby follower, rugby league, and Leeds, Wigan, St Helens, Leeds, Bradford. These are rivals edge rivals, and they don't have no problems. They sit in the stand with each other, and it's the same with the referee, with the culture. With the culture of football. Unfortunately, the culture of referees, you can abuse them, you can swear at them, where that doesn't happen in any other sport. And it's the same on the stands, and it's unfortunate.
And what it needs is a change of mindset. And if people approach it with this, the away fans are not an invading force from another country. Who are kept behind fences. Who need to be corralled by stewards and police. And instead they're just normal human beings and football fans are coming. If we can change that mindset, then I think it'll be a much healthier game.
It's an emotional game, man. I think it's difficult for me.
Well, rugby league, I've been to many of them. That's as emotional and has a similar demographic. In fact, I would say rugby league has got a much rawer working class demographic.
I'm not disagreeing what you're saying, and I think it should change. I'm not disagreeing that at all, but I don't know. So say United, I don't know, Tottenham. You got Stretford in, last minute, Tottenham score a goal. You got 5-6 blokes at the final, jumping up. I don't know, cost United the title, a massive 3 points. United fans are not going to like it. I'm only using United as an example. Regardless of who's there, it's going to cause tension. It's going to cause a problem.
Yeah, but you and I follow the same team, and I can't watch us play with you because you make me a nervous wreck, honestly.
But if we have that attitude, though, it's never going to stop. It'll never, ever stop. Something has to be up. Something has to go on about it. Something has to happen.
I don't know.
No?
We just get...
I personally think it's a difficult one. That's me personally.
It is a difficult one. You're right.
I'm not going to like it. If my team, 90th minute, I've got three blokes in front of me jumping out, rubbing their faces, rubbing it in my face.
Yeah, but
and
you need to get with the times. It's not,
I guess so.
Let's be 100%.
I don't think a group of certain fans are going to stand with a group of certain fans. I think it's going to be like sat with like families and sort of them kind of individuals. When you have a group of lads and they've been on the alcohol all day, obviously, that's going to cause problems.
Yeah,
so,
I guess so. Maybe it's the type of fan or the type of situation.
But they're the sort who are likely to be in the away end. They're not going to go home end. And I think the flip side of saying to home fans, people have an entitlement to come to the match and celebrate when their team scores. They shouldn't be thrown out for it. The flip side of that is, if you are an away fan, don't be a dickhead about it. Mm-hmm. If you score, jump up and celebrate, but don't start turning around and giving it the opportunity to them all and all that. If you're respectful about it, and I think it's what comes down to respect, and what segregation did and creating these barriers, us and them, is eroded respect where people behaved however they could do. And I think I think football fans are better people than most people, it seems. I think that if get bunches of lads who will be across the divides. You know, we've been burying it all day. We'll be like calling each other names. You know what? They're a policing issue, really. It's what I'm talking about is regular fans who are going and just want to see a football match and should be left to do it. And as I say, I think one of the problems with the whole separating the fans and the no man's land and that is it kills respect and created the dehumanisation of the opposition that we need to get over and start moving forward. And it won't be an easy process, and it won't be a short process, but we've got to do something because it's pathetic.
The thing is, Tony, I think going back to the Arsenal game with FC Cologne, I think a lot of it was Arsenal fans. Okay, obviously you've got ones that are very worried about the security and all that kind of stuff, because we've heard all these sound bites from people saying, oh, they didn't check bags, they didn't do this, anyone could have got on the ground, which I understand. But I think on the flip side, for the hardcore Arsenal fans, it's kind of like a pride thing, whereas their ground was taken over. It would have never happened at Highbury. But, I mean, we know, as United fans, Rangers took over the Stretford then in 73, 74 in the friendly. So it's not as if these things happened before. With Cologne, it was a very well-planned, calculated thing, but there wasn't any malice involved. There's just people that wanted to go watch their team play. It's their biggest game for how many decades?
Yeah, and Arsenal was quite willing to sell quite a number of them too. So, you know, I think it's a complex situation. But as I say, that individual incident, I think, should spark off a wider period of reflection on the way football is policed and stewarded and the way football fans relate to each other.
I agree. I'm not sure. You're not sure. We're going to always...
I'll tell you why. Another thing, the football inside of it. The whole point of playing at home is your home advantage. If you've got 20,000 Cologne fans,
yeah,
not really much of a home game after that, is it?
They're in the Europa League. They don't fancy it. I go to Arsenal a lot because it's the nearest ground to me in terms of travel time, where I live in London. And I go an awful lot, and the number of empty seats you see there at the times. Mm. You know what? You want to get behind your team in home advantage, buy the tickets. Instead, the tickets are available. The Germans bought them. And you know what? There's a simple answer to that. Turn up. Yep. You get there first. You've got first choice.
Mm. Yeah. No, that I agree. I'm just...
And do you know what? To rub further salt into the wounds, you've got Arsenal fans that don't want Stan Kroenke, yet they're happy not to turn up and their tickets be taken by someone else, and that money's only going to end up in Stan Kroenke's pocket. Anyway,
and it's away fans, which could...
That's another story for another. But basically, I don't see any problem with what happened. You know, obviously, the security side of things was the major issue, but it improved the atmosphere. And there are some fans that I know that are at the game. They're saying it was brilliant because they haven't seen anything like this before. I've got mates that have been to Tottenham play Beşiktaş in Turkey, and they've seen the atmosphere is actually phenomenal. You know, so seeing flares and fireworks and whatnot in English grounds is unheard of these days, isn't it? There you go. Really, let's wrap this show up with one more story. Controversy in the third tier of German football, where bad sportsmanship was the turning point of the Jena versus Beppe game. Now, with half an hour to play and trailing 2-0, a Jena player went down injured about 4 yards out. Now, in the interest of fairness, Meppen player killed the ball, expecting the referee to stop play. But Soren Eisman had other ideas. Not only did he nab the ball off his opponent, he surged through unopposed and put the ball past the keeper to make it 2-1. Now, to make matters worse, Jena scored another late on, and the game ended 2-2. Play to the whistle indeed. I think that's actually covered on ESPN as well, Tony.
Yeah, well, my view is I hate all this returning the ball and, you know, and stop and play. The play should be down to the referee. If he thinks it's serious enough, he'll stop it. If he doesn't, you carry on and try and score. And I think by being polite to each other in these situations, we've set up like more confrontational situations. So I kind of have no sympathy there.
Well, it might stop people actually putting the ball out of play and stopping every 5 minutes for an injury. If it's not a head injury, play on. Yeah. Or he's kicking the ball out because it's on the floor. So what? It's his problem. Play on. glad you scored.
Let's see what happens next season when VAR comes in.
Oh, yeah. Don't.
Well, gents, it's been an absolute pleasure having you all back on. Tony, thank you for ever so much for coming back on. Before I let you go, mate, would you like to tell us a bit about your new book, Two Tribes?
Yeah, it won't be out until next March, but where it is, it's about the year after Heysel, and how English football was at its lowest point, and then it picked an argument with television, so wasn't even on television for the first half of the season, and basically set against the backdrop of Thatcherism, and a government that regards football fans as the enemy within. It's about the season, which comes to a climax with Liverpool and Everton at Wembley. But it's not just about Liverpool and Everton, it's about West Ham, Frank McAvenny, the first real modern celebrity footballer, West Ham, who were brilliant, United, who won the first 10 games, league games of the season, and went 15 games unbeaten and then collapsed. It's about, you know, it's about race, it's about riots, it's about, you know, it strives to be a snapshot of football and how football reflected the culture of 1980s Britain. And hopefully there's enough that's funny in it, and it's certainly a very, very political book.
And on the final note, it's Meningitis Awareness Week. Anyway, you've got at least 50 kinds of bacteria that can cause meningitis. I know you suffered from it at one point, didn't you, Tony?
Yeah, I was when I was two. I was one of those miracle babies that survived it when the daughter was dead. And thankfully, it had no long-term effect on me. But it's still killing people. It's still leaving people disabled. People are having amputations. And I think people need to be aware of it because the symptoms can sneak up on you really, really quickly. And your sort of rashes, aversions to bright lights, headaches, stiffness. You've made mistakes, so many of them, for colds and flu, and yet by the time you realise it's too late. So it's really crucial that there's awareness about this.
That's right. Well, the Meningitis Research Foundation are doing all they can, and you can obviously go on their website, meningitis.org, and donate if you like. Tony, thank you ever so much for coming on. I really hope you come back on sometime soon and talk a bit more about it.
Anytime. Absolute pleasure.
Great stuff. Rodri, thanks for coming on, my friend.
No problem, pal.
What's your Twitter handle?
Rod James Giggs.
Great stuff. Tony, what's your story?
It's Tony Evans, 92A.
Great stuff. You, mate?
Yannick Istre.
Wonderful. There you go. And we're on Twitter at Shooting Defence. We have a Facebook group page and a Facebook like page. Feel free to leave a comment. Quick shout out to our sponsors. My Sportswear, Youth Energy, FNX Network, Lucky 7 Management, DCF Sports Legal, Bite Back Publishing, and True Start Coffee. I hope you guys enjoyed this edition of Shoot the Defence. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, FMX. Feel free to download the show and comment on YouTube. Till next time, take care.